Hi, I'm Robin Hunneke, and I'm here with you today on the Game Maker's Notebook, speaking with Eka, the CEO and founder of Outer Loop Games. We're going to talk a little bit today about what it means to be a founder, but also what it means to be someone who's loved games and worked in games for a really long time, and to see the potential of our medium, not just to grow, but to change the world. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
So excited to be here at PAX. This is PAX 2019, PAX Prime Seattle. And I'm here today with Eka, and we're going to talk a little bit about games and values and what makes us tick. So when we get started, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about where you come from?
Awesome. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
I'm Eka. I am the creative director at Outer Loop Games. We are currently making a game called Falcon Age.
I've heard of it.
For the PC market. For the Epic Game Store.
That's great. Congratulations.
Thank you. So we're here at PAX showing it off. I started in games 23 years ago, I want to say now, I think.
Old school.
Yeah. Yeah, I got into it when I was 19 at Bethesda Games.
How did that happen?
Let's see.
You're 19 years old.
So I was going to art school in Savannah, Georgia.
Oh, really?
Right after high school for a little while. And then we ran out of money, came back home. Teaching myself how to do art. Grew up doing art mostly. And a friend of mine were going through architecture school in DC area. And they asked me to come on board, and we were doing architecture work for this is a time where this is old.
That's great.
this is before 3D rendering was really a thing. So people were hiring painters to paint a picture of the building they would, build.
Yeah.
So we came in and started doing 3D renderings and fly throughs of spaces. So I got started with them, and we started doing contract work for different companies. Bethesda was one of them. We were working out of a house.
Really?
For a year. I was living there and sleeping and waking up.
Yeah.
10 a.m. working till 3 in the morning.
Doing the grind. Yeah.
Yeah. And in that year I learned a lot of things, how to do 3D modeling and editing and video and things like that. So we were real cheap, we were hungry, working out of a house, and Bethesda hired us to do some cutscene work for one of their games. And then they ended up just hiring us full time.
That's cool. And so then you had an office? Did you go to Bethesda?
Yeah,
work at Bethesda?
Yeah, Bethesda's main office in Rockville, Bethesda Games.
Yeah.
That's where we worked out of.
And so back then, what year was that?
96.
Okay, so in 1996, you had a job working for one of the best game companies in the whole world, and probably nobody even really knew about Bethesda at all, right? Very few people, a normal person, if you just ran into a person at a party and you were like, I work at Bethesda on video games, they would be like, huh?
Right, right. I don't think most people even knew how to say the word Bethesda at the time, but they had been around for a while.
Yeah.
They weren't doing so hot at the time.
I think
they had some games that were... had come out and were buggy, and they did okay, but it was a small studio then. And then soon after that, we worked on Morrowind, which is the last thing I worked on when I was there.
Wow. And that was such a hit.
That was a big hit. And that was really the big sort of moment for them to get bigger and, start they're pretty well known now. I think they're doing decently.
I think they're doing all right. we should check in and see how Todd's doing.
Yeah, Todd Howard was my favorite boss I've ever had. He was really great.
I can't even say enough how jealous I am that you get to say that Todd was your boss,
because
he's
awesome.
Such a great guy.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
and
awesome.
There's not a lot of game companies in Maryland, so a lot of the people I work with there 15, 17 years ago are still there.
Yeah.
So.
That's cool.
And that's their secret sauce, because there's the same team for long periods of time, as you know. You have the same crew working on the same kind of things.
Yeah, you get to know each other really well.
Yeah, and you make better games out of it. So
when you started, you were basically, I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to go to art school.
Yeah.
Now I'm doing this render stuff. Now I'm working in video games. Were your folks just what is going on with you? Were they completely confused?
They were. because they weren't really big on me going to art school either. So.
Oh, really?
So I grew up in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
I moved to the States when I was 8, there's a civil war going on at the time. Yeah. So my parents wanted us to have a better life. And, you know, I was a doctor, lawyer, engineer. Yeah. What were my options? My older brother ended up becoming a filmmaker.
Wow.
I got into games. My sister's in fashion.
So that's amazing.
Like three totally different things.
So. Oh, your parents must be so proud, though.
They are now.
Yeah.
They were fine as soon as I started making money, you know, like, oh, there's a career. Oh, okay, there's money here. Okay. And there's video games. Yeah.
So you did this work and then you shipped Morrowind and then you were like, did you just decide to go off on your own or like what led to you leaving? And like, did you have wanderlust? Like, what was the situation? How old were you when you took
right.
off?
So, Sri Lanka to Maryland and went through high school, Maryland and, you know, was working there while at Bethesda, around 2000, those are dot-com era stuff. So Bethesda was expanding into dot-com stuff.
Oh, wow.
We had a design studio. That's not around anymore at Bethesda. And we had one in London, and we started one in Culver City in L.A. So they asked me if I wanted to go out there, work on, like, cuts. Well, I was doing, like, cutscene and animation work. And we had a crew out on the West Coast to help with that.
That's cool.
I was like, get out of Maryland? Sure. I love it. Go to L.A.? Awesome.
Yeah.
So I moved out to L.A., worked there for a couple years. The dot-com bubble hit and didn't work out. So I was like, I miss games. So ended up moving to Orange County, in between LA and San Diego to work with Dave Perry on, Enter the Matrix, which is like the Matrix console game that was being worked on
at the same time as the online sequels. Game, right?
Yeah. And the sequels. So that was really cool. Yeah.
There were a lot of cool people in that community from what I understand that were, they were really high end animation and special effects people that were now starting to get interested in video games as well. That was a really interesting time in the industry because there were people in film that started to see that video games were like a thing. And I feel like The Matrix was one of those moments where video games and film really crossed over and a lot of people kind of matriculated across this, you know, over into our community from film.
Yeah. Especially that time. It was like, cause the Wachowskis were doing this, they wrote the game. They shot footage for the game while they were shooting the two sequels.
That's cool.
They did the Animatrix, and there's like all this lot of shows and content around the Matrix sequels. So it was fun because we got to meet, you know, hang out with the Wachowskis and like go to meetings. And I mean, I'm not at that time. Like doing a licensed game was a different thing than it is now.
Explain what you mean.
So around that time, a lot of the licensed games were essentially retelling the story from the movie and had to be out the same day as the movie. And that doesn't necessarily translate well to good gameplay or good game design and things like that. So I think these days we're seeing licensed properties that are better as games, not as, you know, not as movies, or I have to follow a movie at
right.
Point,
or so. if they are being made in conjunction with a movie, like the John Wick game.
Right.
You know, they're getting made by people that care about gameplay and they're getting made in a timeline that makes sense for the game, not necessarily the film.
And I think the people that are on the film side have grown up with games and also understand like, oh, this is, we want to work with this person because they know how to make games.
Yeah.
And we should let them make the game with our property, obviously, but
Yeah. I remember when I was first at EA realizing how many licensed games were getting made by smaller developers and how hard they worked after talking about something that was going on at EA and realizing that I had like a 70 person team and this person was like really, really cranking something out with like, I want to say it was like maybe 15 people and they had this insane workload and so much time was being sunk into how to make everything happen faster that they were literally, it was like the bridge was burning out from under their feet as they were running, you know? And I remember thinking, wow, like I've got it made at, you know, at a company like EA, cause you just got so much staff and, you know, something happens, you can just raise your hand and someone will bring you a computer or something, you know? It's like, I remember at that time feeling like it was like in the mid to late 2000s thinking like, it's so nice to be inside the bubble, you know? And of course now I'm on the outside of the bubble, I know what that feels like. But I think it's a good opportunity now, actually. I think licensed games are an amazing opportunity for more independent developers to be working on because of that shift. So you're living in LA and you're chilling out there. Actually you're in the OC, which is not really LA.
Yeah.
Were you like really into games at that time? Were you playing a lot of games? Cause you're an artist, but you're also a developer, right?
So, yeah.
I mean, you know, were you thinking a lot about game design at that time?
Sure. I mean, even before that, I mean, I grew up playing everything. So we had an Atari 2600 and NES, the whole thing. In your neighborhood, you're either NES or a Sega kid.
Yeah.
And
we were NES. Kid.
Yeah. So even throughout at this point, I was still doing some design work and help, and because I was started in fine arts, but you know, did modeling, concept work, would also do UI and think about design process and things like that.
So, yeah.
I was at Shiny for 5 years. We worked on two Matrix games. They're both console games, and we had our first kid. And we were looking to move out of Orange County because it was like so expensive. It was mid-2006. And Beth and I, my wife and I both loved the Seattle area. So we ended up moving up there and worked at a place called Gas Powered Games. Chris Taylor, who that is not around anymore. Neither is Shiny.
Yeah.
Bethesda is.
Bethesda's still going strong.
Yeah. So we decided to move up to Seattle, which is where I live now.
Yeah. And when you came up here and started working and another company, you'd been at three places. How had your experience been? Had you felt like you were, you know, were you treated fairly? Were you, you know, working the realistic hours and all that stuff? Or were you already kind of feeling like pressure to work harder? And like, was it difficult to maintain the balance, or had you kind of made a boundary? What was that like for you?
I was terrible at maintaining the balance. Cause I started at a house working like around the clock, and that's just, we're like, oh, that's just the way you do it, and got to Bethesda, and it's a small company, and mid-90s there was not a lot of talk of crunch. It's just you just do it.
Yeah.
And then during the two Matrix games, there's also like deadlines with the film production, and there's four layers of approval, you know, they're like internally our publisher, the Wachowskis, Warner Brothers, so there's always like this long turnaround, so we had to like work hard on that.
Super hard,
yeah. And we had to hit day and date with the movie, so there's a lot of crunching.
Yeah.
A lot of crunching on those. Gas Powered, very similar.
Yeah.
Yeah, smaller company, multiple projects. If you finish one thing, you're going to be thrown into something else.
Yeah. There's always something on fire.
Yeah. And this is after having a kid, too. I was like, oh, I'll just take it easier. It's like, no, there's just...
There's no such thing as taking it easy once you have a kid.
Yeah, but then after that, I started to like try to figure out my time better because I want to, you know, kind of miss my family, miss my wife, miss my kid. And we had a second one, so I was trying to manage that a little bit better over time.
And what did you do to sort of set the boundary for yourself? Did you just say, okay, like I'm going to leave work at 5 p.m. or like I'm going to say no to more work? Or like how did you start to get into a more healthy place?
Right. Some of those things. It's interesting. At that time, there wasn't really mandated crunch, but there was a lot of peer pressure, right?
Yeah.
From people that are like working on stuff, from, you know, people that run the company. They're like, oh, we really need to get this done to get paid on this milestone, you know, those kind of things. So there's always the pressure that you feel like if I'm leaving early, I'm letting the team down.
Yeah.
And that's just bad.
It's a bad feeling.
Bad feeling. I was trying to leave earlier or come in earlier, things like that. I was still bad at it. You know, it's hard to break a cycle when you've been doing it for so long.
It is.
And you kind of see everybody else doing it. And the whole sympathy crunch thing is also terrible, which means like, you know, there might be another team at the office that have a deadline, but we don't. But you feel bad about leaving early.
Yeah.
You know, or people like, no, you should stay there because they're crunching kind of thing. And it's unhealthy.
Yeah. You know? And so eventually you're raising a family and you're making games and you're thinking about design. What made you decide to start your own company? Like, how did you get from there? You know, you're in Seattle, you're working for someone who's really famous and like working on big games, and your career has been amazing. I mean, if you think about it, right? Like you move here at 8 years old and you've worked at some of the biggest and most famous game companies that exist.
Right.
What made you want to just like take that next step?
So a couple of years into Gas Powered, couple of the guys there started Uber Entertainment, and they asked me to come along with that. This is before the cab company started.
I remember this.
Uber started in 2008, I think. Uber,
yeah, the other Uber,
2009.
Yeah, it was really close.
I'm sorry, 2005, 2006.
Yeah.
I'm so old now, I can't remember the dates.
Yeah.
So that was fine. You know, like starting our own thing sounded interesting. So, and I learned a lot there, like how to market a game. Think about, you know, press and doing shows like PAX, because our really breakout, our first game, Monday Night Combat, the first PAX East was like a huge thing for us. It's the first time we showed it off, people were excited,
people loved it,
and I was like, I was in love with PAX after that.
Yeah, I love PAX.
So a smaller team, and then I started to pitch my own games to publishers and internally. And that gave me the courage to like, okay, I think I could do this. So I signed a couple of projects and did the biz dev part of it. I
was so like, you'd seen it. Yeah.
Okay, I see. It's not that hard. So I kind of had the training wheels, you know, at another company to do it. And I had a good core group of devs I was working with. And we decided 2 years ago to break out on our own. And we got funding for it. So we were pitching stuff while that was going on. So
you did the thing where you you decided to start and you get your crew together and you start pitching. And then at some point you get enough of a support feeling from a publisher that you're like, okay, we're really going to do it. And then you push the button. And then did you get an office? Did you work from home? How did you make the transition smoothly?
Right. So, while I was finishing up a project at Uber, I was still pitching stuff and trying to secure funding because we have no money. and at the same time, I was talking to people like you and, you know, Amir and Jamie at a different other indie companies and Sean to just like advice. And like, how do I do this? And that, I mean, that's something I do now. I pass it on to other people. But like, what kind of lawyer do I need? Accounting, you know, bookkeeping, all that stuff. I didn't know any of it. What kind of company do I make? You know, what's the structure?
How many owners who has what stock of what if you distribute value.
Yeah. I think I spent about a year before starting Outer Loop, just, talking to people and like getting like what worked, what didn't work and things like that. So we started the company, once I knew we pretty familiar with a publisher that I worked with before, so I could trust them when they say, oh yeah, well let's do this.
Yeah.
So I left and then I told the other guys to stay on board till we had money in the bank.
That's right.
It's not real.
It's not real until it's in the bank.
The money's in the bank. Even with the signed deal, I still to this day, right?
Like, it's always the same thing. Yeah. So when we were talking at that time, I think, you know, one of the things we talked about a little bit was values and like company values. I remember when I started Phenomena, which is almost seven now, it turned seven this month actually. I was talking to Amir, and Amir had been in business for maybe 3 years before me, and he gave me a worksheet to work through with Martin, my co-founder, which was basically the worst what if list possible. It was all of the horrible what ifs, like what if Martin get hit by a bus? How does the company transition? What if you become mentally unwell and have to be institutionalized? Like, and it was just a list of all of these really messed up situations. And he had gone through this list with his founders so that they could basically come up with all of the legal framework for how to make the company succeed, even in the case of all horrible things. Now, Amir is uniquely, focused on negative things. Like he'll say he has a black heart, but
it's a really good advice.
It's a great
strategy. I mean, those are realities that he's thinking about before it actually happens. Right?
Yeah. Cause sometimes bad shit happens and you have to think about it. Yeah. So, what were some of the things that you designed your company to avoid?
Right. So, you know, at that point I was, you know, 20 years into games and all my teams at the four or five companies were mostly white dudes.
Yeah.
99% I think I did a talk recently. I went through my credits and just see how many people of color were in those.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, 5%, whatever.
It's like women, people of color, forget it.
Yeah. So, one of the things I wanted to do was start the type of games that I want to make or trying to, you know, showcase and represent cultures, underrepresent cultures and underrepresented people was a big thing for me.
Yeah.
And that's what I talked to my other partners about, and they're all on board too. And we're not like I'll play shooters, but it's not the kind of thing I want to make. So I felt like there's space in the indie space where we could kind of do interesting stories and gameplay. Hopefully, we'll see. We're past the first one.
Yeah, you got one out. That's amazing.
Yeah, and we're still around.
Yeah.
So that was that. And then the other thing was work-life balance. We talk about that. And at this point, I was like, okay, like I want to have a like actual work-life balance. That doesn't mean that there aren't times where I have to work more or less. But so part of that decision was have everybody work from home.
Yeah.
So we're all remote. There's other part of that, too, is the cost of having a studio.
Yeah, it's expensive to pay rent. Trust me and know.
Yeah. And then, I mean, partially also to work with to make games that have underrepresented characters. I also want to work with people that aren't locally to me, you know, people like, you know, Meg, who's in London and Cassandra, who's in Montreal, my Vijay Money artist, he's in India. Like, to be able to do that, having everybody remote makes it, made it easier for us to expand that way.
I think it's actually a big part of the future of creativity and collaboration for game making specifically, is that there are tools now, like we were just talking about this before the interview. If you grew up playing Roblox, you can make a game in Roblox, and you can make it with other people that you met playing Roblox, and they could be all over the world. And you can still, every day, you can get into the creator tool and make it and build it and play it and have fun with it. And like, this is a thing that was just never the case before. Right, like, it's actually a really exciting time to be founding a company, because you can do it very differently, and you can avoid, I think, some of the problems, even the cultural problems you're talking about, that come from the perception of needing to stay at an office. Right. You know, you can get rid of that.
Yep.
If you don't have one, or like in our case, we have, you know, several days a week where many people work from home,
right?
Just because it reduces our carbon footprint, it reduces their commute. Everybody knows the feeling of working from home on a day when you like just can't get in because of something or other.
Yeah.
And you end up getting like three times as much work done than if you get on the train and go in, and then all the, it's just, there's a lot of time spent getting there. What do you think are the sort of successes of the model that you created so far? Like, have you felt like there have been days where you're like, this is just exactly what I wanted? And like, what were those moments for you?
Yeah, I think the leading up to it, having Slack, it's been huge. And then we use Zoom, which is like a video conferencing tool. And that's our office. Everybody logs in with their webcam.
Yeah.
And we'll do our stand-ups. And then we'll turn the microphones and cameras off. And then we can ping somebody if we need to. We can share screens. So those are the things that weren't available before. Internet's fast enough. You can do this.
Yeah.
Do play tests remotely. The benefits, I don't have to wear pants.
Yeah.
On most days. It's great. I take my kids to school.
Yeah.
I go to the gym at lunch or whenever, actually. Yeah. I coach sports in the evening.
Yeah.
So like, for the most part, and I have a very small crew. I think it'd be very different with your size studio, but there's usually 5-6 of us.
Yeah.
So it's easy to manage, and everyone's pretty good about managing their time. The flexibility is great.
I think it's so interesting, if you think about it, how much the industry has changed between when we started in the, you know, like late 90s, early 2000s, and now. And I wonder sometimes, like, what will it be like in 10 years? You know,
right.
Like, we'll be making games on floating platforms in the sea, you know, with like, I don't know, we're like live harvesting kelp to feed our computers or something, you know, like, it just seems like things are changing so rapidly, so fast. And the business is also changing. Like, the way you used to make a game, like if you made a game at Bethesda, if you made something like Morrowind, like you were putting it in the store and hoping that people would go up to it and physically pick it up and read the back of the box and open it up. If you had like a fly box, it was like, oh, look at this. Like, there's a map inside.
Yeah.
And like, I remember like, you know, Ultima, you know, like looking at Ultima and being like, oh, this one has tarot cards. Like, I can't wait to get it home, you know? And it's just such a different experience now.
Right.
On the one hand, I'm a little nostalgic for those days when you would like go to the bookstore and buy a video game because they were in the bookstore.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's created this other opportunity for us in terms of diversity and inclusion and getting games out there that are not just about like other cultures, but are made by people from all around the world. And so when you started working on Falcon Age, you and Meg, I imagine you sat down and had a conversation about like, okay, what is the mission of this game right now? Like, can you describe a little bit about what that process was for you and like,
sure.
And what you decided to do?
Right. I mean, it's, Falcon Age is a VR game. It's also played in non-VR. So mechanically you're a falconer. Thematically you grew up on a colonized planet, been colonized for a generation. So I kind of wanted to do kind of an anti-colonial type game. Cause there's a lot of colonial troops and troops in a lot of Western games. And I wanted to kind of explore the other side of it. So I did like a one page treatment for what I wanted to do with it. And then I heard Meg on a podcast talking about 80 Days, which is very much an anti-colonial type game. And so I just reached out to her because I'd met her, I think, at a GDC party or something.
Yeah.
And we started chatting, and there was a shorthand between us. Having like, she grew up in India, I grew up in Sri Lanka, and having sort of similar backgrounds that way, that made the conversation like, we've never worked with another brown person this way before. And it was like really refreshing.
Yeah.
So we hit it off really well and kind of developed the story. And she took the thing I had and made it good, like, you know, like fleshed it out. And she's a genius.
She's a genius.
Yeah.
She's a genius.
And then we'd have conversations. So she was in London while we're doing this. So 9 a.m. my time, 5 p.m. her time, we would just get together, I don't know, a Skype call and work through things every week.
Yeah. And so when you were working on the story, I remember we were talking at one point about you playtesting this game with your kids, mm-hmm. right? And one of your children pointed out that everyone in the game was a brown person.
Yeah.
And he said, can you really do that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. He's like, you can do that? I was like, oh, yeah, yeah, you certainly can. So, and that's obviously things, you know, thing I don't see so much in games. So I wanted to, you know, it's my company. We
exactly.
can do that. It's our game. So.
And this is the time when if you think about it, in 10 years, maybe that question just won't even be asked.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like when you see something like, you know, Into the Spider-Verse, you know, or Black Panther, mm-hmm. and you think about where would those things have come from 10 years ago? It's just like they wouldn't have.
Yeah.
They just didn't. And they didn't for so long. And now they're everywhere. And it's like, to me, it really does feel like a sea change. You know, this week has been a little bit strange,
yes.
in games. So we've had a Me Too moment on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have been talking at the conference at PAX. A lot of the developers are talking about what does it mean to be a truly diverse and inclusive community in a safe space. It's not always easy to change, like you said, habits,
right.
when they're habits. And you've had them for so long. And I think one of the things that I keep hearing from people is how shocked they are that discrimination happens,
yeah.
or that people feel unsafe. Are you hearing this as well?
I don't understand when people say, oh, wait, women get this kind of treatment.
Yeah.
Like, do you have anyone, and you have any women in your life? Talk to your mom, girlfriend, sister.
Yeah.
Every single woman have had an experience,
yeah.
that have not been good. So it's like, how are you shocked?
Yeah. I think in some ways it's a little bit like when we love something, as much as we love video games, we think they have to be perfect.
Right.
We think that the industry must be great.
Like and every aspect has
every
to be good. Yeah.
Every aspect of the industry must be good. And since we make fun games and in those games people can play together and stuff, that our teams are really diverse and inclusive and
right.
fun. And that's not always the case. In
no.
fact, some of the best games are made in very, very difficult conditions.
Right.
And so it's like they say, you know, you never want to meet the rock star that you think is so great because they might turn out to be a total jerk.
Don't meet your heroes.
Yeah, don't meet your heroes, yeah, yeah. right? And so when you thought about building out the company, like what were some of the steps that you took to make sure that it was a safe and inclusive place? Like not just because you're a brown person, right?
Right,
that doesn't
right.
that's guarantee anything,
no, it doesn't
right?
mean anything, yeah.
So what did you try?
So we started with a pretty senior crew, of people I worked with before. So I kind of, you know, part of being remote, the thing I wasn't sure about is like, if we had never worked together, you know, how, is that more difficult remotely? And I think it probably is, or could be.
Yeah, it can be.
Yeah. So start with a familiar crew of people. And then in terms of perspectives, like I reached out to Meg because she had a really interesting perspective that I thought would be great for the project. And so we just have a conversation. I think I've been around long enough. People know me and like through GDCs and things. Not that I'm like some, like, I mean, personally I've met people.
Yeah.
So that I wanted to work with. So that made it easier. Like,
you
I'm
know,
not a complete dick, I guess.
Yeah.
So.
I can vouch for that. I would say definitely not. I think that the other thing is that you really have made it very clear from the very beginning that this is what the game is about.
Right, yeah.
And you've been in all of your press and all of your talking about Outer Loop, you've been very, I think, very confident,
mm-hmm.
and very vocal about the fact that this is the time for this thing to happen,
right.
which is also, I think, it helps attract the right kind of people, right?
Yeah, I think it took me a long time to get like confidence enough to, well, start a company, but also be talk about, you know, sort of the diversity issue and things
yeah.
like that. Cause it's for a long time, I was like trying to just blend in and just be part of the crowd. And it took a long time.
Yeah,
yeah.
It really does.
Yeah.
What were you, when you were trying to blend in, did you feel like you knew you were doing it? Like, is it a conscious thing or was it an unconscious thing? Like, for me, it was pretty unconscious, I have to say. Like, when I was the only woman in computer science and then I came into video games,
right.
like, it's just the same as computer science. Like, I just was used to pretending that I was just one of the guys for a really long time.
I think, it was unconscious, but also, I mean, like, culturally, I was also, like, ashamed of, like, sharing too much from stuff that's Sri Lankan, you know, or things like that, or, you know, that was like, I was embarrassed.
Yeah.
Of the cultural differences. And that I was like, I don't care. Now I don't care anymore. But like, yeah. And I'm trying to instill that in my kids too. Like, you know, they're, my wife is white, so they're like, you know, crossing two cultures. So we go back to Sri Lanka every couple of years and my mom lives there. And, I want to make sure that they are also growing up that with the right context.
Yeah. And when you're thinking about the future and what you want to do with your company, do you think about like how your games are going to influence potential creators? Do you think about like being an ambassador? Like, is it part of the mission now moving forward?
It is. I'm been mentoring some younger, developers that are, you know, people of color that are coming through. And,
yeah.
I did that at, you know, last GDC. We just had like informal half an hour coffee chats and like ask me anything you want.
Yeah.
I'll talk about my experience. I just started a company recently.
Yeah. Office hours.
Yeah. You know, and also I talked to my wife's a teacher, so we go talk to her school class and things like that too. And doing stuff like PAX is really, really important to me. Being able to be on the floor.
Yeah.
We announced our game at PAX last year, Falcon Age, and having this giant banner with a brown girl on it, I could tell people were walking by. They're like, oh, she looks like me.
Yeah.
Like, that's really cool. You know, like those kind of things are, I think, is really, really important.
As we continue to push forward with making games for different audiences, what do you think are some things that we can do as a community to sort of broaden our perspective or to reach more people? Like, you know, are there things you think about from the marketing side, like ways of getting the content into the right hands, that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So I love Twitter. It's a terrible place, but it's also a really good way to test out things. And that's what I'm seeing now. I see creators that are brand new. They're like, just throw something up, right? Before we'd be like, oh, we don't want to share it till it's done. But, and then they'll find an audience, right?
Yeah.
If it gets traction, then it's like, oh, this is the thing I should keep working on. So I try to promote people that way too. But also that's how we promoted Falcon Age, was like throw stuff on Twitter and,
yeah,
and see what hits, see what it doesn't, and then do more of that or do less of that if it doesn't hit.
Some examples of stuff that hit?
Oh, so after PAX, you know, it's a game about raising a bird. So there's a baby bird in the game. And I think one of the first gifts was like petting the bird in VR.
Yeah.
And that just like viraled. People really like birds. I mean, people like cute birds and
they
pets.
Like cute birds.
And another thing, we were you started in a colonizer prison, and one of the prison cells, there's like a demotivational poster, which is like, earn, you know, graduate from here and you can go off planet work and earn a pet. And so we put all our friends' pets in there. And I just tweeted about, hey, do you want to put your pet in our game?
Yeah.
And that blew up too.
It did. It was...
People like, the other thing people like is, yeah, sharing their pet photos.
They do. I contributed a dog photo to that thread.
Yes.
And I just did one for the National Doggy Day. I was one of the millions of people that sent the dog photo to this stupid We Rate Dogs Twitter.
Oh,
I love that.
I love
that so much.
You,
and
I'm
the first time dog owner. So this is like, I'm just getting to have the joy of being like, no, seriously, look at pictures of my dog.
Yeah. 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 No, it's awesome.
It's so funny.
Yeah. I mean, those kind of things are just, you know, they're like, oh, this might be interesting. And then you find an audience. So I think there's a lot of free ways to try to find an audience. Social media has been great for that. I mean, it has its bad sides to it too, but.
Do you ever feel like you're at risk of being targeted? Do you ever feel like, you know, oh, I don't want to put this out on Twitter because blah, 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 blah.
I do think about that, yeah, especially when I travel internationally now. I mean, I'm a U.S. citizen, but I'm like, yeah, am I going to have an issue coming back?
Yeah.
You know, because I had friends that went to, you know, we live in Seattle, we go to Canada a lot, and
yeah,
they have their phone searched and social media accounts. And so I do think about it.
It's crazy.
Just because, I mean, I don't mind going back to Sri Lanka, but my family's here.
Yeah, exactly.
My life's here. So.
Your life is here.
Yeah.
And well, and this is one of the things that, like, now games can start to address these issues. We can really start to think about them. I often say this, and I think it's more true every year, that games are a way of sort of imagining futures, right? You're thinking about futures by building the games you build,
right,
and you're thinking about modeling certain kinds of behaviors and certain kinds of social structures. And for example, this idea of the colonialism, that like the metaphors that are in a lot of games,
mm-hmm,
we have a lot of conversations about that at Phenomena.
Yeah.
And the game that we're working on right now, one of the games we're working on, has a large social component, and we're doing all these weird social prototypes because we really want to understand what online social spaces are like,
right,
you know, not as in like, you know, when we made Journey, when Mark and I worked on Journey, we talked a lot about, okay, how people play together online, but that wasn't a community space. Mm-hmm. It was a personal
shared
space between two people. Yeah. Yeah. And so like, what is a community really like? And I've looked at a lot of games, and a lot of online games have these kind of command and conquer structures inside of them, mm-hmm. right? Like the way the guilds are and the way that you have to get together to do a raid and the way that you're supposed to kind of grind at the behest of some higher powered person,
right.
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, even if you look at something like Eve, right? Like it's in a way, it rationalizes itself to a relatively steady state where there are two or three very big superpowers. And then there's not as much of a skirmish anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like mm-hmm. everything kind of settles into this power structure. It's very interesting to think about, you
yeah.
know, like yeah. we build these things in almost by accident, I
right.
think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing this a lot with Fortnite. It's turned into, you know, we used to go to the mall, and my kids are in Fortnite. They'll go into, you know, playground mode and just yeah. hang out with their friends and do dumb things.
Yeah. And it's like when you create that kind of a space, if you're doing dumb things and you have the capacity to support one another, mm-hmm. then you can be kind to one another.
Right.
But if you don't, then you kind of can't,
yeah.
right? Like you can
yeah.
use the chat, but that's it, right? And all those kinds of things are, it's a very interesting space. Do you think that your kids think of that as playing video games? Like if you ask them if they played video games, they'd be like, yeah, I play Fortnite. Like, do you think that they even were really conscious of how much they're just hanging out in there?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are. But also, they also know they're playing video games too.
Are you the kind of parent that gives them specific hours so they have screen time?
They have chores in the morning. Mm-hmm. So they get up earlier than I do. So by the time we get up, the chores need to be done.
Oh, nice.
They're not always done. So if you're in the middle of
get
Fortnite,
me some kids.
If you're not in the middle of a Fortnite match and you don't want me to hit that power button, so you better do your chores. In the summer, they get more time, but
yeah.
usually during the school year, they are both in sports and there's not a lot of time to do it.
Would you encourage them to become developers? Do you think that you feel now like the community is safe enough to put your own kids into it?
Yeah, I mean, we built games together in a little bit, but they didn't show a whole lot of interest in it. But like my older one is more like an engineer focus. So when we built, you know, built a bread box and did like these sort of engineering things. And he was more into that. So we'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you start thinking about your next games, like, are you kind of imagining like what the future will be like? Will you grow the company? Will you stay the same size? Like, where are you in terms of thinking about your future?
Yeah. I mean, we're going to probably stay under 10, unless we don't, but I mean, right now it's like 5-6 full time. And then we have a handful of contractors. So,
in a way you're kind of your own little community, your own little online community,
right.
which you manage through these two tools.
Mm-hmm.
Would you ever consider working together in your own game? Like, would you make a game and then work in it together? Like,
oh,
Roblox.
That'd be interesting.
Wouldn't
yeah,
that be cool?
That'd be cool. Yeah.
I think about that a lot.
Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about like what if Phenomena could become completely distributed, but also we were always working in our own game.
Right.
I think that'd be pretty awesome. I feel like that's kind of the possibility of now, is that you can be distributed and networked in a way that was actually kind of better for the planet, maybe.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
know,
yeah.
like we have a sort of strange lifestyle in that like we end up traveling to conferences
mm-hmm.
where we do all of our business development,
right?
Right? Like, so when you want to make a deal, you have to like fly to Germany to go to Gamescom and then talk to all the publishers.
FaceTime, yeah.
Do you think that'll change? Do you think people will eventually will all be doing our pitches over Zoom?
It could be. Yeah. I mean, I think body language.
It's hard.
It's, you know, and then having face-to-face time. I mean, I think video makes that a little easier, but like it's different.
What about VR? Do you think you could pitch a game in VR?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I feel like you could.
I did do a whole interview in VR.
You did?
For Falcon Age. We had, so the PlayStation VR community, like they're pretty hardcore on Reddit. So they put together in Rec Room, they built a Falcon Age set.
Wow.
Or they built a like a talk show set, and they put like designer like around Falcon Age, and they invited like 10, 12 different people from around the world.
That's cool.
So we were all in our headsets in VR with avatars, and they had a physical microphone. You would pass it to the next person, and the audio was coming through there. So that was made it easier. So not everyone was talking over each other.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's
all,
really neat.
All in Rec Room, which is
See,
insane.
That's
yeah.
that is the future. That's what I'm talking about. Like,
yeah.
what what the hell? Like, when did we set the fan communities are also so activated, right? Like, yeah. I mean, your fans love your game. They love the bird. They love the gifts. They love seeing you guys out there. And it's like, it's so different, right? Like this idea of being secret, like while you're working on stuff. I have always found it really difficult as a designer because it's like, you know, when I get obsessed with, like, right now I'm obsessed with the fashion in my game. So I'm like looking at, basically I'm looking at Pinterest and all this stuff all the time. And I get to the point where I really need to talk to other people about it in order to process what's in my head. And I've been designing this game for about 5 years now because I'm low and slow. But like the idea of not being able to talk about it for another 5 years or whatever, like, you know, if it was a big game, that would, I think that would make me pretty nuts.
Yeah, we're thinking about that for the next game. I mean, I have 3 ideas that are kind of noodling in my head and we're starting to concept them out. And but I'm like, can I start sharing this stuff? Should I, you know?
It's a hard question, right? Because you want to basically motivate people, but you don't want to give people the wrong impression, right?
Right. And there's a whole, like, the marketing PR angle of things. And if you end up, you know, signing with a publisher, they might have their own goals in terms of, like, oh, this is for announcement for some release thing.
But if you already kind of announced
it, then
they kind of can't. Yeah. You know, if they want it bad enough, then they're just going to have to deal with the fact that you have a public audience.
But then you see stuff like where a GIF will blow up and they'll get an epic deal out of it, right?
Yeah.
Like, they'll sign a game on because of that. That's
And then the community will get really angry.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about that?
Because
I feel like this is the other thing that's been happening is that in addition to the sort of Me Too moment that we're having, there's also this reckoning that's happening with, like, thinking about, like, what our player base is like and how we communicate to them effectively. Like, Ek and I are both just human beings, right? We're trying to make creative content and support other artists and build stuff that we think will inspire other developers out there. It's a little scary sometimes like you can get on the bad side of your own community.
Right. Yeah. So with, I mean, me starting a studio and releasing Falcon Age, we assumed we're not going to sell any units.
Same.
And we have to be financially okay because there's salaries and, you know, we medical benefits and things like that. And people have lives and kids and mortgages. So, you know, as a company head, I constantly think about that. I'm sure you do too.
I do all the time.
Like, see, how much money do we have left in the bank and when does it run out, right? Like, that's like indie games is that, right? Like, get more money coming in before this stuff runs out.
Before it runs out.
Yeah, so that's why we're pitching all the time. And so we had an opportunity after we shipped Falcon Age. We were going to do Steam and do PC. We hadn't announced anything, but Epic reached out. I mean, it'd be dumb for me to say no.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, this money, and we're small, so it's like, this money would be, I can plan the next, you know, whatever, 6 months to a year, knowing that our company will be fine, our people will be taken care of.
Yeah.
And we can work on, you know, shipping the PC version. It'll be out on Steam too, but, you know, it's like there's the guaranteed money is, it's really, really great.
It makes your life so much better as a boss. When you're responsible for all these people's lives, when you know that you have runway, right? Like, even 6 months runway, you know, which could be, it could be as little as a couple hundred thousand dollars for, depending on where you're working and what your team is or whatever. It doesn't have to be millions and millions of dollars, just a little bit of extra money in the bank. It makes such a difference to your level of confidence, your level of awareness of, like, just everything else around you. Like, I know when Phenomena goes through a really narrow period, I'm always so focused on the day to day. Like, I'm just really in the moment. And it's very hard to look up from that because you're worrying about that balance sheet and you're thinking, okay, we've got to get this done. And then a game does well, or you get a really good deal, or both. And then you're like, oh my God, the feeling of being able to go, we have enough money until next year. That feels amazing because your mind is immediately free of the stress.
And you can focus on creative stuff.
And then you can focus on, like, pinning fashion stuff.
And future game ideas.
And future game ideas and partnerships, right? And I think that one of the things that we don't really communicate enough as leaders is just how important it is to have that positive feeling. Even if things are tight, even if your company is, like, maybe you had a game and it got canceled, or you have a partner and they're paying late, which is often the case. You know, even when things are stressful, if you can, like, manage to just look up a little bit over the horizon and see how much good you're doing in the lives of the people that you work with, or how much your fans love your games and that kind of stuff, that level of being able to look up and take a deep breath is so important to your own ability to secure more funding and to do more good work, right?
And your health.
And your health. You have to be able to breathe, yeah. Right? You need to be able to breathe. What do you tell yourself on the tough days?
I talk to my friends.
Yeah.
I talk to my other studio heads, and they were like, "Hey,
we got you.
It's gonna be fine. You work something out." It is tough because there are sometimes when you're especially dealing with other partners, you're like waiting for some, you know, a milestone payment, and it's gonna be late, and so you know, you gotta hustle.
Yeah.
And because it's not really their fault in terms of like. It's a big company. Like for them, it's like 30 days, 60 days, whatever. For us, it's like,
oh my God,
world's on fire. Bank account is going to be zero here.
You're just so. Looking at that zero. Like,
yeah.
Oh, no, negative.
I go walk outside, play Pokemon Go.
That's good.
Or focus on something else.
Yeah. Just got to get away from
it. Yeah.
Go to the gym.
Go to the gym.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you can, you know, and I'm not telling you this, anything you don't know already, you can just go nuts doing that, right?
Yeah. I think that one of the most important experiences I've had is the sharp contrast between thinking something is not going to be financially successful and then overnight having someone step in and be like, I would like to make this an exclusive and it's suddenly becoming successful.
Yeah.
Just the one day difference between there's no deal in place to there's a deal in place is, and then you go, wow, like I was so worried about that.
Right.
I had no idea how stressed I was. And now I am not stressed. And the absence, it's actually like there's a Buddhist principle of the gap, right? Like when you're meditating, if you breathe out and you wait before you breathe in, there's a gap between breathing out and breathing in. And in that gap, you're still alive, but you're not breathing. Mm-hmm. And if you focus on that gap between the out breath and the in breath, that like that is the moment where you can be truly present and at peace, right? And it's very hard to do because your brain is usually filled with discursive thoughts. But but that gap is also, I've heard it described once by Pema Chodron, saying she was meditating in a meditation hall and there was a fan in the background. It was going, and then at some point the fan stopped. And then and she's like, oh, that's what it's like. Like, it's just the absence of that anxiety, the absence of that self-talk, the absence of the, when you realize that it was there the whole time, then you go, oh shit. Like I was really stressed.
Yeah.
You know, over time, what's happened to me is that every time I have one of those gaps, it reinforces the fact that the not gap stuff is not real.
Mm-hmm.
It's an illusion, right? You're making it up with your mind.
Right.
You're talking to yourself.
Yeah, if I had to communicate everything that happened in our business to our fans, it'd be nuts. I mean, it'd be bad because it's like every day it's like, oh, we might be have to close tomorrow.
Yeah.
Next day, oh, it's fine.
Yeah.
We're fine for another 6 months. and there's just back and forth all the time. That's part of running a small business.
Even with Bethesda, like you said, right? Yeah. They'd been doing okay and they had a couple of games that didn't do well and it wasn't looking like they were going to make it, right? Yeah. And then they went into the .com stuff and that they probably lost a lot of money on that, took a bath on it. But staying focused and keeping moving forward, you know that Todd Howard has a million stories, I'm sure, about how things could have gone if they had gone differently, right? So in a way, it's kind of humiliating and humbling, but also really encouraging to know that it is 99% of it is just timing.
Yeah.
And putting yourself out there. Would you say that you wish you had done it sooner, or do you feel like you picked the right moment?
I don't know if I was mentally prepared for it or had the confidence.
Yeah.
I started a company at 40. I wish I started at 30.
I started my company at 42. So as well, I should say at 40 as well.
Yeah.
I think it's a great time to start a company because you kind of don't give a shit anymore.
No. And you've done all the dumb things earlier, so. Hopefully it'll be good.
I'm still doing dumb things.
Yeah.
I feel like occasionally I do dumb things.
I mean, like when you're in, you know, personal dumb things.
Yes.
Like,
you know. Yeah. Yeah. And you've gotten your life hopefully sorted out by the time you're 40. If you haven't, then maybe you'll be that 80-year-old. But I do think that this is like it's a fundamental thing as well that we don't talk about that much, that like there is a level of self-confidence and like foresight and like really believing in yourself that you need because it is so anxiety provoking. And there's just so much randomness in games in general, right? It's an entertainment business.
And I think for a long time, like before Amir and Jamie, I think I wouldn't have the confidence, like knowing that there's like, oh, these other, you know, non-white guys also doing it.
And they're doing it so well.
Yeah.
They're super successful. Yeah. My personal mentors have all been people that were designers and then became business owners at the very beginning. That was who I was talking to mostly. Yeah. And Amir was working with me at EA, and I actually went and taught a class when he was still in school. My friend Bernie was a lecturer in New York, and I taught a class that Amir was in. Like, I went and gave a guest lecture at a class that he was in. So I've known him since he was in school. Sean, too.
Yeah.
I've known Sean Vandeman since he was, like, just out of school working at Disney.
Right. Yeah.
It's weird now to have them be mentors and, like, people that are more successful, but it's also so great because it shows you that you can literally be working next to somebody and they can be just an intern, and then you turn around and they've made a super successful studio, or their studio got sold.
Yeah, so don't be a dick.
So that's kind of where I'm going with it. Yeah, it's like, don't be that person that thinks that you know everything anywhere ever, because you never know, right? You literally never know. Yeah. The world is a big circle, and what goes around comes around.
It's a small community.
It's a super small community.
And especially this week with all the allegation stuff coming out, which I think is really healthy. It's hard to read, but
it is hard to read.
It is empowering other people to come out, and that's great.
I think if we continue to do what we're doing and be honest about what we're doing and how hard it is, then hopefully other women and queer folks and people of color and people from all over the world will understand that, you know, you're just as likely, honestly, if you work hard and you put yourself out there, you're just as likely to be the next hit. And you're just as likely to be able to sustain, a lifestyle business that really supports you and that you can thrive in, where you can work with people that you really love. So you're here at PAX. Are you showing Falcon Age again? What were you doing here at the show floor?
Right. So last year we announced it for PlayStation, and this year we're announcing it, or we're showing it off for the Epic Game Store
version.
And it'll be out in a week.
Oh, wow. That's so exciting.
Less than a week. Right after PAX.
Yeah. How much is it going to cost?
$19.99
on the Epic Game Store.
VR and non-VR.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thanks
you are
for having
amazing
me.
And inspirational, and I just love what you do.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks. Thank you again for listening to the Game Maker's Notebook. I really hope that you enjoyed our discussion. If you would like to support the podcast and more content like it, please consider leaving us a rating and a review. In addition to this podcast, the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences also produces Dice Summit. To our listeners currently working in games, Dice Summit is the premier speaking and networking event in our industry. Dice will take place from February 11th to 13th at the Aria Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. If you would like to learn more about the summit, please visit www.dicesummit.org.